My name's Al. I'm an alcoholic. These books to me are like a binky to a baby. I take them everywhere. Okay, I'd like to thank Anthony for asking me to speak. Welcome the newcomers and the birthday people. August was a very good month to get sober. Oh. Well, at least most of you don't know me. So, all right, my sobriety date is 8/24/93, and I got sober in Clovis, California, the Fresno area, and I would like to tell you that my first drink started when my baseball career went belly up, but that wouldn't be the truth. It started when I was 13, and a friend of mine had stolen one of those funny cigarettes out of his brother's room, and we tried it because he told me how happy his brother got when he smoked it, and we got happy, and then I went home, and I told my sister about it, and she turned me on to my first drink, which was Slow Gin. And and her and her girlfriends were singing and dancing and having a good time. And before you knew it, I was singing and dancing and having a good time. And I was hitting on her girlfriends. And I was pretty shy around them before that, you know. And that liquid courage turned in, and that's where my journey started. You know, and fast forward a few, you know, oh, back up, I'm sorry. But as far as baseball, I ended up getting connected through that, through school. I grew up in a rough neighborhood, very rough neighborhood. I grew up in Berkeley, California. And I would go to Oakland quite a bit, and back to Berkeley, and back to Oakland, and back to Berkeley. And back then, if you left your neighborhood, you had to fight your way through every other neighborhood. And that's what we did. I started to get in a little trouble, and that carried over into school, and I got in a little trouble at school. I think I was in the fifth grade, and my teacher, God bless her, man, I used to go back and see that lady and until the day she died, you know, and she sent me to a coach, the baseball coach, in this elementary school, and I had to report to him every day at a certain time, and so did the other kids that were in trouble. And he's the one that got me into baseball, and there's a long story behind that, you know. But I wasn't into baseball, but he had this hot shot pitcher, and you know, they were throwing the ball, and I was ripping it over the fence, you know. So he got me, you know, to go to a park on the west side of Berkeley, which we called the waterfront, and it was a rough area, and I loved it over there. You know, I fit right in. I knew all the guys, and I was very good at the game. And about 14, the scouts start showing up, and they start talking to my mother and my uncles. I didn't know my dad. He left when I was 2 years old, and I never knew my dad. And I'm just, you know, the drunkalogue part, I'm going to keep very short. You know, I'm not that guy anymore, but, you know, I do have to tell my experience here. I have to tell the truth. You know, I messed it up. You know, plain and simple. I had scouts looking at me. I had scouts talking to my uncle and my mother, and that's a lot of pressure when you're 14 years old until you get out of school. You know, constantly, constantly, constantly. You know, I remember the Pittsburgh Pirates organization showed up one time and out of the blue and just wanted you know to show my skills, and they worked me out, and then you know. Kansas City Royals, they were just starting up back then, and they showed up and they wanted to work me out, and you know, and it was very overwhelming, very overwhelming. And anyway, somebody asked me the other day, hey, I heard you played baseball. I heard you played, you know, from high school to baseball. And you know what? I just told him. He said, how long did you play? I said, about 3 minutes. You know, because it lasted 3 months, and then I got hit by a car because I was drunk and I walked out in front of a car. You know, and that was my first bad episode. You know that was the first bad luck I had. You know, couldn't have been the alcohol. You know, it had to be the little lady that, you know, could barely see over the steering wheel. You know, and it was just bad luck. But there was a lot of shame, guilt, and remorse behind that bad luck that I never let out until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of shame, guilt, and remorse. So I get back home, and, you know, I knew a lot of people at home, and there was a lot of people offering me jobs, you know, car dealerships. I didn't want to be a salesman, you know, other places. And, you know, I took a job for the railway system. And, you know, I took that job, and all they did on that job was drink. That was my kind of job. You know, from the superintendent down, they drank, you know, and they drank like me. You know, and we traveled, and we went out of town, and we drank. All our layovers, we drank. You know, that's all we did. We drank. And, you know, it progressed, just like the book says. You know, this is a progressive disease. I was the guy that was the happy drunk when I first went into the bar. I was a bar drinker. And I went into the bars, and it was always, hey, yeah, how you doing, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and it was always, you know what, line these guys up, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, before, I was pretty good at going in there and just keeping a pretty level head. You know, I did that for a long time. But at the bar, before I went to Fresno, I was so shameful, you know, because we grew up poor. I mean, we grew up dirt poor, you know, and that shame and remorse just kept kicking in, and it chased me until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was, I wanted a job where I was going to make good money, because the two guys that I grew up with and played ball, I'm watching on TV playing ball, Major League Baseball now, you know, a few years later. You know, I seen one of them played in an All-Star game. The other one played in the World Series. And I keep seeing that, and it's a reminder, you know, it's a reminder to me that I'm a failure. I let everybody down. My mother knew nothing about baseball. She didn't know baseball from tiddlywinks, you know. You know, she would come to award dinners because I got a lot of awards back then. And she knew nothing about it. You know, she would just say, oh, that's good, mijo, that's good, you know. And, you know, and then I had, you know, uncles, and they didn't push me, but I had one uncle through marriage, you know. And he told me, man, I mean, he would tell me, he was an alcoholic. He would get drunk and tell me what a failure I was, you know, and until I clocked him one day. You know, and that's the truth, you know. I couldn't take it anymore. And I threatened him, you know. And I told him what a drunk he was. You know, me, I was telling him what a drunk he was, you know. Took his inventory real quick, you know. And you know what? It hurt. It hurt so deep inside. And I just couldn't let it out. I just couldn't let it out. And it didn't matter what I did. I remember those days going to those awards and... you know, when I played baseball, I fit in. Man, did I fit in. When I went to the awards places and when the game started, the practices were fine. But when the game started, you know, I was tuned in until one day, one kid says, hey, where's your dad? How come he's never here? You know, and one more time I had fit in, and then I was a part of, you know, and then I wasn't. You know, and I was different, man. You know, I was different because back then, everybody had a mom and dad in my neighborhood, except for me. You know, and in my family, they all lived around each other, you know. And my uncles, you know, they were like fathers to me, you know, and they were all the brothers and sisters of my mother were working two and three jobs because they were, you know, they had their goals set on building a business, which they did and succeeded at, and it got very, you know, it got very big. And, you know, by the time they got their businesses going, I was already out of school, you know. So in the bars, I met a couple of people. And I'm back, and I have the job, and I found a new profession to get into. I found out that, you know, when I was being offered car salesman jobs and stuff, I didn't want to be a salesman. I found out I was a hell of a salesman in this new profession I got into. The only problem was it was an illegal profession, you know, and I made large sums of money, you know. This is my wife right here. She's gorgeous. And one time, me and my family, we're Raider fans. You know, I'm from the Oakland area. And they always went to the Raider games. And my wife tells me one day, she says, I got us tickets to the Raider game. It's a surprise, right? I have a motel for us to stay at. Is the Embarcadero a good place to stay? I said, oh, it's nice. They got a couple nice places. I know good restaurants right there. We get in the room, and I'm looking around, and I'm going, oh, my God. You know, I didn't expect her to get a place right there on that side of the Embarcadero. But it was nice. She opens the blinds and stuff, and she's looking out. She's looking. And I guess she sees the look on my face, and she goes, what? You know, and I said, straight across over there. I said, that's the warehouse. I said, that's the warehouse where it all came down. I said, that's the warehouse that we kept all the stuff in, you know, that had an escape route built in it and everything else. And I said, and that's where it all came down. And you know what? I was sober. You know, I was sober quite some time. And man, just for that to come back, you know, and I laughed it off with her, but it did. It had somewhat of an effect on me that day, you know. And we went on and enjoyed it, you know, because, you know, I didn't want to spoil her surprise, and it was a great surprise, and we had a great time, you know. But you know, that's what I faced for many years when I went back to the Bay Area. I went back to the Bay Area, and I think at this time I had 7 years sobriety. And I went into my favorite deli in Oakland, and it had been there before I was born. And I went in, and I came out, and there was Oakland PD, lights going on, parked behind my car. And I walked up, and this cop had arrested me. And he wanted to know what I was doing there. And so, you know me, man, I got 7 years sober. I don't care what you got. I want to know what you're doing here. You know, and he says, you know, you need to get out of town. You know, and, you know, and he followed me. He followed me until I got on the freeway. And I was just pissed. I mean, just pissed. Boom, you know, I get on the phone, you know, and I call up my sponsor. You know, and he says what we all love to hear. He says, Al, what's your part? You know, and we start breaking it down. You know, if you wouldn't have put yourself in that situation, you know, if you wouldn't have did the things you did, you know, he wouldn't have had any cause to do what he did. You know, and that was it, man. You know, and I couldn't believe it. You know, and those were just, you know, some of the growing spurts. You know, I had the lifeline to call. You guys provided me with a lifeline to call, you know, and I did it. It took me 5 months to pick up and make my first phone call. It took me almost, I'm not going to lie, you know, welcome to the newcomers, guys. It took me almost 18, 19 months to surrender to this program. I hated this program. I wanted nothing. Frank was there when I first came in. You know, he's a transplant too. He's one of us from over in the valley. You guys don't like this valley, guys. I golf with some of you guys, and you guys just say, hey, why don't you go back to the valley? You know. And, you know, I was rough around the edges. You know, I mean, there's a lot more. You know, there was a lot of arrest. You know, there's jail time. There's all that crap. Anyways, I get to Alcoholics Anonymous after my last arrest, which came out great. You know, God definitely had a plan, because I had signed to do a couple of years in the penitentiary, and they lost the evidence, and that's that. And that's where my journey started. I went through a rehab. Some of you AA guys came in the rehab. You know, I was supposed to be there for 6 months. I got evaluated with an anger problem, and I was there for 9 months, and you guys kept coming, you know, and you guys were going to pick me up when I got out, and you guys sure did, because I got out, and I thought I had this thing licked. And the minute that door closed behind me, I went down those stairs, and I thought, man, I can go to the bar, and I was heading there. I had no transportation. It was at home, because I didn't have a license for 14 years. I'm walking to the bar, and lo and behold, you guys, you people, that's how I identified you, you people pull up in a car, pick me up, and say, hey, and the guy says, hey, you can go get a drink later. And I'm going, you know, who told this guy? You know, you know, and you know, I went with him. We went to St. John's in Fresno, and we went to a noon meeting. And we went to that meeting, and those guys in that car, you know, they took me home. I was a single parent, you know, hid that from the courts. I was still fighting a court case, which went on for a long time. And I'm losing my train of thought, but they took me home, and that's why she's sitting right there. And they took me home. You know what? And they hung with me for the rest of that day. We went to an evening meeting. You know, I got to, you know, hug my sons and all that stuff. And they took me to a meeting, and I met Jerry L. Frank knew Jerry L. quite well. And Jerry L. was in Matt Green. And those two guys, man, drove me freaking nuts. You know, and Matt Green was a single parent too, and he was blind. He was legally blind. You know, he could see like shadows out of one eye. He had put a gun to his chin, pulled the trigger, you know, and you know, it wasn't God's plan. And he had a distorted face, patch over one eye, and he was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And he was my grand sponsor. And Jerry L. was my sponsor. And Jerry L. was this big guy, and I walked into Sierra Fellowship over in Clovis. I walked in there, you know, and everybody's coming up, welcome, 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 you know, and they come up, and I put my hand out, you know. And after the meeting, guys are hugging, you know, and blah, 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 you know. And they come up, and, hey, you introduce yourselves. And they lean. I said, whoa, don't hug me. I said, I'll shake your hand, but do not hug me. You know? And then this little guy, Alaska Joe, comes up, little redheaded guy. And, you know, today he has 30-something years, and he says, hey, my name's Joe, man, you know, and I said, get out of here. You know? And he did. Later on, we became very good friends. You know, he at the time, he didn't ride motorcycles, but I rode motorcycles, and later on, he got a motorcycle, and it was one of the funniest things I ever seen. You know, but, you know, that's how it was for me at first, except this one guy, Jerry L. You know, he had did 16 years altogether in the penitentiary. You know, he a big guy. He had prison tattoos. He had white boy written on the back of his neck. And I just focused on that. And this guy Cruz used to sit next to me. He was new. And I would sit back there at the first, you know, first few meetings. I would tell Cruz, I bet I can knock this guy out. You know, because he was pissing me off with what he had on his neck, you know. I says, I know who he hung with in prison, you know. And old Jerry L, man, you know, he'd come up to me the next time I walked in. Nobody hugged me. But Jerry L was a big guy. And he would walk up, and I would go, no, no. And he would push my arms to the side and lunge in and give me a big, tight hug. And I would just like that. And you know what? He taught me then, you know, what you hear around here all the time. I brought my book. I'm going to read some stuff after a while. He taught me how to love myself. You know, he says, and he told me, we're going to love you until you can love yourself. And you know what? He taught me how to love myself, respect myself, and forgive myself. You know, and that was powerful, man. You know, because I felt so much guilt and shame when I came in here. So 18 months go by. I'm fighting other stuff in court. I show up, and things worked out like I was hoping. And I'm walking out of court, and I'm sober, you know, and I still haven't, you know, surrendered to doing the deal. I'm still trying to do it Al's way. And Al is miserable, man. Al is just miserable. I walk in meetings, and all you guys are smiling and laughing, and, you know, very jovial, man. You know, and you guys, you know, I'm sitting back, you know, Cruz, man, these guys are so fake, man. Look at these guys. You know, I says, watch, somebody's going to say something funny, and they're all going to laugh together, you know. I mean, I didn't take one. I took everybody's inventory, you know, and I had a co-signer. Oops. Sorry about that. I had a co-signer. And I'm leaving court, and the bailiff calls me. And he says, you want to come up here and look at this on his computer? And I looked at it, and he goes, that's you, isn't it? I said, yeah, that's me. And you know how we do in court. You know, you stand back and you put your hands in, and he cuffed me up. You know, and haven't worked much of a program. He cuffs me up. He tells me the short timers from Wasco will be here in a minute. The band's going to pick you up. He says, you know, and he did say this. He says, and you guys can do the shackle shuffle all together. You know, and I was pissed, man. So I said some pleasantries to the bailiff as he took me to the holding room. And, you know, let him know what a piece of you know what he was. And as he's taking my chains away and, you know, and my watch and, you know, putting it in the manila folder. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. You know, in my head, hey, I've been doing AA. I hadn't been doing anything in AA but going to meetings. You know, I was in no type of action at all. I secretaried a meeting because I got blindsided. You know, I will hold to that to this day. And, you know, they invited me to a business meeting, and I didn't want to go. And he said, I'll just come check it out. It's on Monday night. Just come. I said, I watch football Monday night. I don't go to business meetings for AA on Monday night. I said, I'll just do this one for me. I show up, you know, and we have a secretary position for Monday night, and I don't know how it works. I nominate Al. I second. All in favor, aye. You know, and I'm doing a Monday night meeting, and I'm pissed every Monday night. You know, and that's how it went. That's how it went. And so I get thrown in jail, and on the way in the van, I see this gentleman and his little boy, and he has his hand, and he's holding his hand, and he's walking, and I swear, that's where my spiritual awakening started to kick in. I see that happening, and for the first time, I wanted that. I wanted that to be me walking with my boy holding his hand instead of going to jail and making that phone call and saying, hey, you need to get Derek from school. You know, I'm going back to jail. You know, and I go in jail, you know, sober. And I get up on the pod and I call this girl that was a friend of mine. And we were good friends because she didn't like AA much either, and she was gay, and people back then, some people didn't like her, and me and her hit it off real good, you know. And her name was Deborah, you know, and I let her ride my motorcycle in the gay parade up there and stuff, and she was like my sister, and I was like her brother, you know. And we talked a lot, but Deborah seemed to have better talk than I had as far as AA, you know. So I would listen to bits and pieces that she said. So I get to the pod, and right away, you know, at first, you know, I didn't want to be there. That's different. And before I didn't care. And I go up in the pod, and there's this 18-year-old kid, just turned 18 a couple days before. So he's with the adults now. And he looked, I mean, he was ready to cry. And I pulled that kid over and said, come here. And I said, I'm going to tell you right now, you cannot start crying in here. You know, I said, you stick with me. And then, you know what? And old Al came back. You know, and I said, you stick with me. You're going to have to get up early in the morning. I said, you're not used to getting up at this time. And you're going to have to go get your breakfast. And at breakfast, they're going to give you your lunch. It's going to be a sack lunch. And I says, but I'm going to take care of you in here. But you're going to have to give me part of your lunch. You know? And he was going for that. And so, excuse me. So the next day comes around, and I have an inhaler because I had to see the nurse, and she gives me an inhaler. The guys from Alaska, they have things. You know, they brought things from prison. They're doing their short time now. And we're figuring how to hook my inhaler up with what they have, and we're going to get high. Right? You know. And the last time I was in jail, I would have probably had a week earlier sober, but I got high. So, anyway, so, you know, this is happening, and I'm really thinking about this, you know, and this kid is next to me, and all of a sudden, and this is why I say I had my spiritual awakening that day, because I said, wait a minute, you guys do your thing, I'm sober, now I'm Mr. AA, you know. You know, these guys think I've been working a program for almost 2 years, you know, and I just said, hey, I'm sober, and I'm not going to give it up. And then Joe Blow over here says, I was sober one time. He says, but if it wasn't for her, you know. And the next guy, I was sober too, but it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, that bad charge they threw on me. And I heard myself. God was talking to me right then, you know, and I thought, I'm not getting loaded. I am not getting loaded in here. That's me. That's me talking right now. And I didn't. And then the only place I could get cleared to go in at that time for H&I was a place called Fresno Care and Guidance in Juvenile Hall at that time, because Juvenile Hall, you didn't need any clearance, and neither Fresno Care and Guidance. And one of the guys from Juvenile Hall worked at the jail part-time, and one of the guys at Fresno Care and Guidance worked at the jail one time. And they caught wind that I was in there, and they wrote letters for me, and they let me out on my own reconnaissance with a $10,000 bill. And at that time, they weren't supposed to let you out with a $10,000 bill. And, you know, which was better than the bill I had the time before, because it was a $100,000 bill. And so I get out, you know, and I go to the men's meeting, big men's meeting over there. And that Saturday, it was in a little tiny room. You know, if you guys have been watching the news, it gets hot in Fresno. And it was in this little tiny room. You remember that room, Frank? And it had a little window unit that wasn't even big enough for the little tiny room. And it was smoking in that room. And I told myself, no matter what, I was willing to go to any lengths to get sober. And I went to that men's stag, and I told him that day, I says, hey, my name's Al. They called on me. I says, I can't do this alone anymore. I said, I need help, and I can't do this alone. And, you know, that's the day, you know, that I asked for help. You know how hard that was for a macho, tough, you know, hombre like me? You know, it was like, wow, you know. And when the meeting was over, guys came up to me. Frank knows over there. Those guys will come up over to you. They will come to your house. You know, and Matt and Jerry were doing that anyway. They walk in my door and open the blinds and, you know, let the sunlight of the spirit come in, you know. And yeah. And I was like, what the heck is this? You know. And, you know, and that was part of my journey, you know. And me and Jerry, we start working on the steps. And how long do I have? I want to make sure I don't. 15 more. We start working on the steps, and you know, we got to step one. We went through the doctor's opinion, man, and that was all Chinese to me, you know. And I was the guy, man, that I wanted to debate everything, you know. I was debating the society, you know. And I wanted to debate everything, and it was Matt, you know, my grandfather, you know, and he used to say, you should have. And then he nicknamed me Elvis. You know, and all those guys would crack up, man. You know, you should have read further, Elvis. You know, it just pissed me off. He used to piss me off so bad, I told him one time, you know, if you weren't blind, I'd hit you right in your eye. God bless you, Elvis. You know, and loved him to death, you know. Laid on the bed with him a couple of days before he died. My wife was there, and we were leaving town. And got to lay on the bed with him and thank him for everything he did for me and my son in sobriety and helping me become the man I am today. You know, and I got to do that with my sponsor also. I was with him with his last breath, you know. What a blessing, man, to be able to do something like that. You know, and so we go through step one, and after we do the doctor's opinion, and... And I bring her step one, and I'm proud, man. I did step one, and Jerry looks at me. Do it again. Who flunked step one in AA, you know? So I did it, and I went home, and this time I did what he said. I did exactly what he said, not what I had said. And, you know, and we did it, man, and it was great, you know, and he pointed out so many things. I mean, it goes way deeper, you know, than the lists he had me make, you know, the powerlessness, the unmanageability. You know, I told him I really don't have anything for unmanageability. He said, Al, you're fighting a court case. Normal people don't fight court cases. You know, and, oh, okay. You know, but then once he sat down with me, you know, at his table, at his house, you know, I mean, just so many things opened up just on step one, you know, and, Yeah, they know I'm here. So, and then, you know, and then he says, okay, you did this part of step one, good. He says, now we're going to do people, places, things, and situations. And we got into people, places, things, and situations on step one. And man, you know, there's always that, okay, now, what's your part in all this stuff when you're bringing the people and the places and the situations, you know? And you have to look at your part, you know? And we're digging deeper and we're digging deeper, you know? And I'm starting to look at things differently. And then we do step two, you know? And the best thing I liked about step two is I looked it up. I looked up, you know, the restore, you know? And I wrote it down. And it's to return to your original form. You know, I wanted to be the kid I was in the younger days, you know, before I got to my teen years. I wanted to be that, you know, finally wanted to be that loving, caring person. I wanted to be a good dad. I wanted to be a good neighbor. I wanted to be, I wasn't married at the time, you know, but I wanted to be, you know, just a good mate, you know, and so we got past step two, you know. Because when I read Step two, I was ready to restore me to insanity. I really did at first. You know, and then one day I said, no, that's sanity. You know, and I started to get some sanity. You know, I started to understand, I started to listen. You know, I had great teachers before me. I just didn't want to listen because I was always taking your inventory and I was always pissed off. And then, you know, we get to step three you know, I learned a lot about God's will for me. You know, and I learned that, you know, I had to take the action. You know, I had to do the prayers. You know, my first prayer was simple. Matt Grimm says, "Al, just go home and ask God to reveal himself to you every day." You know, and I did it for a long time. And I said, "Yeah, nothing's happening, Matt." He goes, "Oh, there's a lot happening. You just ain't seeing it." You know, and this guy's blind, mind you. He says, "Why don't you show up, meet me in the parking lot before the meeting, and we can pick up cigarette butts together." Remember that, Frank? He says, you know, we can work on humility together. So I showed up. We're in the parking lot, you know, and I'm just, oh, this is boring. This is stupid, you know. And we did it, and before long, you know, and he goes, "And you can give Jack a ride home." Jack in a wheelchair. I said, "I ain't giving Jack a ride home." You know. I said, "I am not giving him a ride home." No, you can give. Because the guy, my first meeting with Jack was, he's in a wheelchair sitting next to me. And 20 minutes later in a meeting, he's up pouring coffee. And I look and I said, "You phony," you know. And I didn't know he had been in a motorcycle accident. You know, and his balance was off and stuff. So he needed a wheelchair. You know, and I just didn't, you know, I didn't like Jack, and I'm not giving him a ride home. The meeting's over, and I'm giving Jack a ride home, you know, because I'm taking direction. Okay, so I'm taking direction, and guess what? Me and Jack became pretty good friends. I start calling him up. "You need a ride to the meeting after the meeting. You need a ride home." You know, we're such alcoholics, as you know, when I said, "You need a ride home," he went, no, "I got one." I'm like, "Well, you son of a gun." You know, I'm up here and I'm talking nothing like I used to talk. I won't cuss up here. I won't cuss up here because she's giving me the 5 minutes. 5 minutes? 10? See? And, you know, because I was taught to respect myself and to respect others. And to respect Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's for me, you know, in a meeting. If you guys want to talk any way you want, that's up to you. But for me, my sponsorship line said, when you speak in front of other AAs, you take those leathers off, you take all that black clothing you wear every day off, and you come cleaned up, you put on a tie, and you look, you know, because you're representing Alcoholics Anonymous. And you look presentable. So that's why I do this. You know. This morning, I told my wife, and I start crying when I told my wife. I said, I was talking to Jerry this morning, you know, and you know, he passed away. I was talking to him, and I said, I was doing one of my morning readings. And I said, and it wasn't on the day that I was reading. You know, it was just on the next page. And the next page was, because this is what Jerry used to tell me. And I thought, you know, Jerry, I'm speaking tonight. You know, I'm going to do what we do. I'm going to pray to God with my wife before the meeting to speak through me. And that's what we did out in the car before we walked in. And this is some, and then I read today's reading in this book, the 12-step prayer book. And after I read it, I looked down and I was asking, you know, I wanted some kind of sign from Jerry. And I told her what it said and I started crying and said, "Today, I pray I may give to my enemy forgiveness." And Jerry used to tell me this. "To my opponent, tolerance. to my customer service, to a friend kindness, to all people charity, to my family my heart, to every child a good example, to myself respect. I told her, I said, I seen that this morning, and I was talking to Jerry and talking to God, and I said, then it hit me. And I started crying when I told her this, you know. It just hit me. I am so blessed. I could have missed it all, you know. And instead, here I am, man, carrying the message like he told me to. When that man was on his deathbed, he was worried about me and made sure to tell me, you make sure that Louie and John get a sponsor and you get one too. I'm working with Matt. He said, I'm working with Matt. You know, and that's what he said the day before he died. You know, he carried the message to his death. So, you know, I'd like to go through all the steps, but I don't have time. You know, the fifth step had so much in it, you know, for me. I mean, it had so much in it. A part that always stands out to me in the fifth step was, all right. It says when we reached AA for the first time in our lives, stood among people who seemed to understand the sense of belonging was tremendously exciting. We thought the isolation problem had been solved, but we soon discovered that while we weren't alone anymore in a social sense, we still suffered many of the old pangs of anxious apartness. Until we had talked with complete candor of our conflicts and had listened to someone else do the same thing, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship with the man in God. You know, and that stuck with me when I did four and five until this day. You know, and it goes on and on to talk about more that I have highlighted. And this is my original book. I got divorced also in AA, and I was never going to marry again. I was never going to date for at least a few years, and then the stalker came along. look at her, she's going to get me. Me and a buddy of mine who I sponsor, who has a few months less than me, she walked by, you know. She was flirtatious, and she said she wasn't, but then she texted me because her sponsor, who was a friend of mine, had to leave, and as he says, you know, make sure she gets away home. You know, right away, I said, I'm not taking her home, you know, and she goes, well, make sure she gets away home. You know, she's having a rough day. She might not get through this day. So I got another lady, and it was for 60 days, and we got her a 60-day chip. And after that, she texted me. I don't know how she got my number. I can't remember. But she texted. Oh, Cheryl. She got my number, and she texted me. And I show my buddy. I said, look at this crap. I said, I'm not texting this chick back. You know? You know. But you know how you women are, okay? You know. You don't take no for an answer. And... you know what? You know, she rode her bike in 102-degree weather down to where my business was. And she showed up, and she had a sandwich. You know, and I told her, you're bringing a sandwich to my food business? You know, and she's just ignoring me. She's sitting down at the table, and she's opening it up and, you know, giving me my half over here and her half. You know, she was on a mission, you know, and... you know, but today she's my wife. You know, and that was 13 years ago, and I love her to death. You know, I grew up. I learned how to be a man. I learned how to respect people. I learned how to respect women. You know, and I was the guy that dated four of them the first year in AA. That was the only good thing about AA. You know, and so I'll close with this. Okay. And she takes care of me, because if she was up here, she'd grab this and she would see it here. So, okay. I like closing. I read this on my birthday every year. Okay. Okay. This is in Keys to the Kingdom, last page, 276. And I'll say it in my years of increment. The last 29 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I have had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is a handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligations, we require relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. The ache is gone and never need return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.